You're listening to SMU Voices, podcast produced at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas.
This is Mustang Physics, Episode 5, Sonifying Subatomic Particles. Everybody, to another episode of Mustang Physics. This is your host, Professor Stephen Sekula from Southern Methodist University. I'm flying solo today, so I'll keep the introduction short and go right to our interview. Our guest today is Matt Bellis. He's a postdoctoral researcher working at Stanford University in California. Now, Matt has many interests. In physics analysis, he's interested in understanding why it is that the universe came to be so imbalanced, why there's, for instance, more matter than its opposite, antimatter. But in his physics spare time, he's interested in finding ways to bring new audiences into a connection with the data of particle physics. Now, how do you do that with non-physicists? I mean, the Large Hadron Collider is collecting one of the largest data sets ever taken by a group of physicists on the face of the Earth. It takes a global network of computing and disks and software just to analyze that, looking for elusive little subatomic particles like the Higgs boson that may or may not even be there. So how do you bring non-physicists into a connection with particle physics data? And this is the question that Matt Bellis has gotten interested in. And during our conversation, he gave us the whole story behind how he got interested in this and how his own project has developed out of his work with physicists and non-physicists alike. So I invite you to sit back and enjoy this discussion.
To start off the conversation, so Matt's been doing research on an experiment that I also work on called Babar. But in his non-research time, which is also still research time, he's been playing around with how to connect a mass audience to modern particle physics data without making them have to use all those awful data analysis tools we're stuck with.
Right. We want to do the hard work for everybody else, and then everybody else gets to play with the data.
Right, because after all, that's how we all got excited about this stuff in the first place. We went and played with something and thought, oh, I wonder how that works.
That's right.
Or I wonder what that means.
Yes.
And, well, here we are now, right?
That's right.
Thank you for joining me today, Matt.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So I think the first question I have for you is what is sonification of data?
So I believe if you look up like an official definition of sonification, I don't think it's even a word. I think it is this term that has evolved out of people who have tried to take data and turn it into sound. If you do Google sonification, you'll find workshops and conferences dedicated to this idea of basically visualizing data, but in a sonic sense. So what I've been trying to do is take aspects of particle physics data, the Babar experiment that you mentioned, and turn it into sound. I think if you really want to trace it back, you could actually go back to the music concrete movement of the 40s and 50s, where you had musicians like John Cage taking random generations of something and turning it into sound. So there was a period of time where John Cage, the avant-garde composer of the 50s, used the I Ching, which was this Chinese maybe fortune-telling device with sticks.
Where you use coins,
is that
basically to roll, you throw the coins and depending on the pattern that you get, you read the pattern out of a book that tells you, it has some kind of cryptic fortune phrase that you're supposed to interpret.
Something like that, yeah. So I don't know, it's something like that. And he was using that to generate notes for musical scores. And there's other aspects of this random, or sometimes you'll hear it referred to as aleatoric music.
Okay.
Nobody at the time was really saying, well, let me hear some data. Like when I talk about data, I'm assuming that you have some data set that has some underlying physical rules, some underlying physical representation.
And you're trying to look at that data and figure out, well, what are the rules?
Well, when we do our analysis,
analysis of that data. Yeah.
That's right. When we do our analysis, we take that data that looks random, right? It's a bunch of noise and numbers and stuff, and we try to pull out some understanding of the universe. Or people may be looking at data sets that represent some aspect of society, population growth, or number of doctors within a society. And you can just take these numbers and turn it into a graph,
okay.
So maybe a bar graph or a pie graph, a pie chart, and then you look at it and you try to understand what's happening. There's no reason you can't take those numbers and turn it into notes of a certain pitch or of a certain timbre or duration. And I think that's what sonification is all about. There are people that are trying to use this as a way to learn more about the data. They say, well, look, it's basically another axis, another dimension that I can use to interact with the data. Maybe I will learn something new. I don't think with the particle physics data I'm leaning in that direction. I think for me it's a hook to get people interested, but I think those people can also be not just the general public, but graduate students or ourselves, you know, listening to the data, getting excited about it. Maybe we do gain some extra intuition, or maybe even just trying to figure out how to map the data onto sound, we learn something about it. But that's my understanding, my novice understanding of sonification. Yeah.
Now, this idea of sonification of data was something that you brought with you to a event called Science Hack Day SF, which was actually in Palo Alto, California, even though SF implies San Francisco.
That's right.
What is Science Hack Day, and what does it mean to bring an idea to that event and then have it discussed?
Right. So let me explain what I understood Science Hack Day to be, and if any of the listeners want to Google Science Hack Day, they can probably find a little bit more about it because I wasn't one of the organizers.
Okay.
However,
so you were a participant.
I was a participant.
Yeah.
So there was the idea of a Science Hack Day arose out of hack days, just a regular hack day, which was amongst the hacker and computer culture, which was the idea you get a bunch of coders together in a room for a weekend,
mm-hmm.
and over the course of 72 or 48 hours, you put together some application, some website, some snippets of computer code to do something. So people come with ideas. And it's fueled, you know, I think stereotypically they're fueled by caffeine and junk food and enthusiasm.
Okay.
Right? This is the stereotype of that. And I'm sure actually it's not quite so stereotypical that way. But you get a bunch of people and you just pound through the work as much as you can in a short space of time, get as much people working on a project as possible.
But basically, these are self-selected, interested people who like look at the list of things that they could be working on that weekend and go, I want to do that. I want to work with these other people on this project to do develop a website.
That's right.
Or
that's
some
right.
application or something.
Sometimes
like
that. It may be for work. Sometimes it may be like, oh, I want to hack a new driver for the Linux kernel, and let's get a bunch of people together who are interested in kernel hacking and do this. So apparently a group of people said, well, why can't we have something like this but more related to general science rather than just coding? Can this work? And in 2010, in the summer of last year, they put on an event like this at London. And then they said, well, can we duplicate this in the States?
Mm-hmm.
And there was some interested people. I think there was some overlap in the organizers between London and San Francisco. But basically what the organizers did is they put out a call to other people interested in science outreach, so some science journalists, some scientists that they knew,
mm-hmm.
Some enthusiasts. There were some artists that came, some coders, web designers, and they reached out to some scientists and they said, can you bring some science projects, either material things that you want to build or some data sets and some interesting ideas, something different to do with the data, which you could recruit a few people and try to get a project going. So David Harris, who is a science journalist, was one of the organizers, and I knew him from when he was working at Slack. He said, do you have any ideas? And we were bouncing back and forth stuff to do. And I'd had this idea that I've been playing around with for a couple years and never really got off the ground, and this was this idea of sonification of particle physics data. So he's like, oh, I think this is a great idea. We'll get people interested, and I'll work with you on it and stuff. I'm like, oh, that's great. So that's at least
neat.
One person
ahead
of time, right?
So you got a scientist and a science journalist,
and they're enthusiastic
about this idea, and who knows if anyone else will
Right. And you and I know Dave, but we should also mention Dave himself is a scientist with a physics background and does computer coding himself, you know. So we show up at this Science Hack Day one Saturday morning. This is in Palo Alto, and I think there was, I don't know, I'm terrible at estimating numbers of people, but probably between 50 and 80 people.
Yeah, based on the photos you showed me, it looked like it was about that.
Yeah.
So
everybody gets together in a room. Everybody introduces themselves using this hashtag device where people stand up. They give their name and they give three things that identify them.
Okay.
I think I identified myself with physics, Linux, and football. That's American football. This was during football season. This was last November. And then the people that they had talked to about projects stood up and gave a 2 or 3 minute explanation of their project. And then people broke up into these self-selecting groups and listened to a bit more detailed description of other people's projects and then decided on whose they wanted to work on. Mm-hmm. And there were some people that didn't get quite as many people volunteering, so they glommed onto other projects. So after we gave our discussion, by about 11 a.m., we had a group of about 6 or 7 people set up in one of the little conference rooms, and we started talking about what we wanted to do, which was to take particle physics data from Babar, turn it not only into sound, but set up a website by which other people could come and play with the sonification of it. And it was a fantastic experience. I mean, it was, we had this one person who was a physicist also from Lawrence Berkeley Labs. There was this other gentleman who was a physicist who wasn't working at the time, but it was out of grad. So I think he just finished undergrad or grad school. I think he finished grad school.
Okay.
His wife was doing web design at Sandia National Labs. There was another guy there who worked for Yahoo, and another guy who did web design for the Alder Planetarium in Chicago.
Yeah.
And so first thing we started talking about, well, what's the format of the data? And then you say, well, what is the data? What are these numbers in here? This column is the X component of momentum.
So you came in with sort of basic guts level subatomic particle information that a detector produces, location, speed,
so
all that stuff. Okay.
Interestingly enough, I actually did not have as much data as I wanted. This was my part of the hack, and it was going back and forth with Tim. So I came to the I came there that day with some Monte Carlo data, and basically I had 4 vector information. So for those listening who aren't as familiar with that, I basically had the momentum of the particles and the energy of them.
Okay.
And I believe at the time I actually didn't even have a particle ID. I didn't even know exactly whether or not the particles were pions or kaons. Mm-hmm. And I thought that maybe I could quickly hack together something to get the data from our data stream. But instead what I wound up doing was I coded up for myself a mock detector.
Okay, which was faster than going back into the Babar data set and trying to mine that out.
Yeah, it turned out to be faster. It still took a few hours. I coded up something in Python, put in a magnetic field, and tried to see whether or not a particle was close to one of the detector elements. So I had these discretized detector elements. And then I could control how many layers of a particular detector there was. But then I calculated the velocity of the particles as they would go through and said, well, it should hit this part of the detector at this many nanoseconds, and then this many nanoseconds at this point. And 12 nanoseconds later, it hits this part of the detector.
Yeah.
And again, working back and forth with the people on the project, like, okay, well, do you want the information in XYZ coordinates? Do you want it in, you know, spherical coordinates? Well, I'll give you both, but now I need to tell you what columns things are. And we worked in text files. And then there was a lot of discussion about what was the right computing tools to use, because it turns out, and some of your listeners may or may not know this, it's actually really hard to generate sounds in your browser. There is a new web standard coming up, HTML5, which will have more of this. And there were people there that knew, this was back in November, and they're like, if we're using Opera or Firefox 4, we might be able to get this going and we can hack this together.
So basically, like, bleeding edge web browsers would be able to support this fully.
That's right. At the time, probably bleeding edge now, hemorrhaging edge back in November would probably be it. So I had been messing around just in the last week before this all started with a language called Processing. Processing is a language developed for artists to do computer animation. If you go to processing.org, you can see some fantastic examples that they've set up to render in the browser. It runs on Java, but it looks like C. It looks like some Java. It's very simple. You can dump an applet to embed in your web page. And a lot of people have written libraries and extensions of it to do 3D graphics or sound, it turns out. So we'd been going back and forth actually over the course of the night, and it wasn't until like evening of the first day that I was able to get something working in processing.
That's pretty fast, actually.
It was,
I mean, to go day one to decide to switch to a new language that you haven't used before? You hadn't used it?
I started using it about a week or two before.
Oh, okay, but still, that's pretty good.
Well, what was great, what was great for me was once I was able to get a demo version working, some very simple proof of principle, and I think the other guys in the room had been messing around with some other programs, and all of a sudden, I've got sound coming out of my laptop. And they're like, oh, what's going on? Now, it turns out the other people at the room had been messing around with processing way more than I. And so even though I'd gotten something Scratch working, now I had these people that I was like, okay, wait, how do I do an array in this language? How do I do a loop in this language? How do I do this? So now it becomes this incredibly collaborative feedback mechanism where we're all really working together on this.
Drawing on different expertise, different experience.
That's right.
Pretty neat.
So at the end, we had a mocked-up version of a website. We couldn't get it to run live on anybody's browser, but we were able to get it to run live on one person's browser.
Okay.
So on Sunday afternoon, everybody makes, or maybe even Sunday before noon, everybody makes their presentations. We had like 2 minutes to present it. And we were able to play sounds. And in real time, we were actually able to select and take, let's say, a particle's energy and map it onto the volume of a note and take the angle that it comes out and match it onto pitch and things like that.
Okay.
And in real time, we were able to make our demo by taking things like energy and mapping it onto volume. If you have an event that has a lot of low energy tracks, on average, it will sound quieter. And if you have an event that has a lot of very high energy tracks, it sounds louder.
Right.
But it will have fewer of those tracks. Because you start off in the same initial state with roughly the same amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
If you break that up into 6 tracks, they will have higher energy than if you broke it up into 20 different tracks.
So I guess we should say at this point that the Vabar experiment, what it does is it takes electrons and their antimatter counterparts, positrons, and smashes them together at what is, by sort of Large Hadron Collider standards, a fairly modest energy.
That's right.
But
that's
the beauty of using electrons and positrons is, as far as we know, they're fundamental particles. There's nothing rattling around inside of them.
That's right.
So when you annihilate one electron and one positron, you get all the energy of the collision out in new forms of matter. So this is Einstein's E equals mc squared writ large. So you get mass that comes in, it turns into energy, and then that energy converts back into mass. And that might come out in the form of 2 particles, 4 particles, 12 particles. And so it's sort of, you have a fixed amount of energy and you get to divide it up into 12 buckets. If you have more buckets, you're dividing up the same amount of energy into smaller pieces, and that's what you're hearing, basically.
That's exactly
right.
When you
map energy to volume.
That's right. That's right.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating. So, and we were able to, in the 2 minutes, as we explained it to people, I actually posed it as a question to people once I explained what the mapping was. So why is it quieter or louder? And there were people in the room that were able to get it. And now you start to see the power of having these other hooks to get people interested in the science, as well as starting to understand it. And what was fascinating to me over the course of that evening and those 2 days was this handful of people that were not particle physicists. And it's midnight, and there's people in the room that are talking about, well, what should we do with particle ID? And if it's a muon, should it sound different from an electron? And if it's coming out at cosine, oh, wait, is this theta or cosine theta? And people who hadn't thought about this stuff before, and they're all getting really involved in like, well, if this is the drift chamber and it's wires, should that sound different than a calorimeter, which is crystal? And how would
so
we
you
do
know,
this?
Like, well, should we know the difference when a particle is passing through one part of the detector versus another?
That's right.
And so this was sort of a self-generative discussion amongst people that are not either practicing physicists or not even physicists at all.
That's right. That's right. So, and a little bit of a pat on our backs. We actually won the People's Choice Award.
Oh,
so
cool.
People voted for that.
All right. So only 50 or 80 people voted. Neat.
And we also won the Best Use of Data Award. There was a couple of other projects for like Best Physical Project where people manufactured something. There were some fantastic projects. And if people, I'm sure Steve will provide a link to my webpage that details
we'll put that
this.
In the show notes.
And that'll have some links to the Science Hack Day itself and some pictures and some discussions of the other projects and stuff.
Cool.
Now, over the course of this this weekend, I learned about a similar project that's being done with LHC data.
Okay.
This is called LHC Sound. I think there was an NPR story on this a little while back. There was a postdoc at Argonne National Labs named Lily Asquith, who has been working on this for some time. They have a very nice-looking website set up. It's a little bit less dynamic than what we had tried to do. They actually take physics processes that have been simulated in the Atlas detector, they've turned them into MP3 files. So you can play it and you can hear what a Higgs event might sound like versus a top quark event. So these are, again, very different physics processes. They may sound different.
When you sonify them.
Basically. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. So it sounds a little bit different, but not that different from what we were trying to do. It's interesting. I've actually been in touch with Lily. We're both very enthusiastic about each other's projects and have had some good conversation about ways that each of these could develop on their own for a while, maybe ways that eventually they could either pass data back and forth or merge into a common project. That's down the road.
Yeah.
One of the things we're trying to do is add some visualization hooks to this as well. So the sound and these visual cues appear at the same time on the screen, which we could not get running over the course of that weekend.
Okay. So you had sound only at the end.
We
of
had
that
sound
weekend.
Only. That's right. And I think this is what the LHC sound has also right now is just sound. But we talked about the idea of a common data format amongst all the different experiments, such that you could play different particle physics experiments.
Yeah.
And if it's general enough, really, I think you could take this and dump other data sets that aren't particle physics data. Maybe it's weather information or cosmic ray information. Or
right. Like solar weather.
Solar weather data.
Stock market data. Yeah. Stock market data would be interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, some of this stuff probably is more random than others. But I find it interesting, this idea of listening to data that you know has some underlying significance, some underlying rules, and trying to see if you can hear that, even if you very much choose how to hear it. So our project at Science Hack Day, let me back up a bit. Our project at Science Hack Day was called Particle Physics Wind Chime, because I'd had this idea in my head of using the detector like a wind chime. So if I back up to what I think about a regular wind chime is, the wind itself doesn't make noise. The wind itself doesn't make sound. You hear the wind if it rustles the leaves in a tree or blows something against your house or blows past your ear and sets up some resonance cavity vibrating the air in your ear. The motion of the wind itself doesn't necessarily make a sound. But if you build a wind chime, if you build some hanging bars and you put it in the wind interacts with that wind chime and moves it in a certain way. You have chosen whether or not those hanging bars or whatever is making noise are wood or metal or shells that you found on the beach. If it is wood or metal that you can cut to a certain length, it's you who are deciding whether or not it's a C major pentatonic or, you know, a D minor, the saddest of all keys.
Right.
It's up to you to make that decision. So in the same way, I'd had this image of using these detectors like Atlas at LHC or the bar at SLAC as a wind chime. And when you have these particles that pass through the detector, they set it ringing and resonating in some way. And then what we really wanted was a way for the user to decide how to match those particle physics properties or those detector properties onto the timbre, in the same way that you would, if you were making a regular wind chime, cut the rods to different lengths or use different materials. So there's this project.
So let it be a very subjective thing
to the
audience. Then.
That's right. Yeah. Because why should I decide how particle physics sounds?
Right.
You know, I'm not, you know, an expert in sonification, let alone, you know, the expert in all of particle physics that I should know what it should sound like. And the truth of the matter is there is no one who's enough of an expert to say, there is objectively one way that this stuff should sound.
Right.
So you let
that's not art. Right?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And then there's a whole other artistic aspect to this. And it was great. You know, there was this one woman, Jennifer Monfrenz, who was at this Science Hack Day. She's an artist, and she's done work of images of women scientists. And she was incredibly enthusiastic. She was the one who actually told me about LHC sound. And she's a science enthusiast who wants to turn science into art. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, great. I mean, forget about trying to even understand the data, taking what we do and making some really beautiful aesthetic representation, I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Well, it certainly extends it to an audience that otherwise wouldn't necessarily be engaged.
That's right.
Right. And that's the whole purpose of that.
That's right. That's right. Or they might want to feel that they could be engaged,
right,
and they just feel it's so overwhelming.
Yeah.
How can I ever, you know, do... So every now and then I think about, like, so in Star Trek Next Generation or something like that, or Doctor Who or some sci-fi show that's set in another civilization or far in the future. Every now and then there's a reference to blah, 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 quantum mechanics taught in elementary school, you know, or blah, 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 my first high school string theory class, right? And there's some assumption that a lot of this stuff that we're learning now that's cutting edge becomes filtered into the general society and becomes something that's taught to either the general public or every kid in school.
Right.
Getting from here to there is non-trivial.
Yeah.
I like to think that there are projects like this or things that other people are doing that find ways to get it to seep into the culture that maybe 100, 200 years from now, you know, the work that you and I have done together that was, you know, brand new measurements for the first time are just part of somebody's element, you know, maybe not elementary school, but high school curriculum.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly finding ways to tap into different interests of different groups of people to make the same subject approachable from every direction.
Yes.
Boy, that would be great for physics.
Yes, right. That's right, that's right. Because in the end, you know, what we're doing has to be for the whole society. It has to be for everyone. If you and I are doing research that only 20 or 30 people can understand, that's not fair to the taxpayers that fund us.
Agreed.
But on a moral level, it's not fair to the society that has chosen to allow us to work on this. We have to find ways to explain it to anybody who wants to know what we're doing. No matter how obscure, no matter how difficult it is, the onus is on us to be able to distribute this to the general public.
Yeah.
That's hard. It's hard sometimes to explain stuff that you know really well, but we have to keep trying.
Yeah. All right, so I'd like to hear some of this.
Okay, so let me
why don't you fire up
play
some of those.
And I'm sure if it takes a little longer than otherwise, we can fix it in post.
Take your time. Yeah, we'll edit it out in post.
All right. So...
there's no post.
Oops. One mapping of the data, hopefully I'll be able to hear it, where I've taken, as Steve said, the beauty of the Babar experiment was that it created a lot of beauty quarks, B and B bar.
Yeah.
Those turn into B and B bar mesons, which decay into a lot of particles. So you're going to hear a sonification where you have many tracks in a given event. And what I've done is as the tracks emerge from the center of the detector,
where the collision happens,
they go to a higher and higher pitch as they leave the detector. And as I mentioned, this detector is very simple. There is an inner region composed of about 20 different layers, which has one sound, and an outer region, which just has one layer and has a different sound. So let's see how this works. So those were events where a B and a B meson, a B meson and an anti-B meson decayed. You get a lot of particles in the final state. I can also look at events where we produced a tau plus and a tau minus.
So those have leptons. About like a third the mass of the B meson?
That's right.
Roughly, and so they're a lot lighter. A
lot lighter, will decay into fewer particles, but those particles will have a higher energy and momentum on average. And if I listen to those using the same sonic mapping that I used for the previous sample, it'll sound like this. So they sound quite different. I can choose different mappings for, so in that one I mentioned before, the pitch is based on how far the particle travels from the collision point at the center of the detector. But I can choose a different mapping of the sounds, maybe where I take the momentum and map it onto, I think I did pitch for this one. And if I play the original sample of those B mesons and anti-B mesons decaying, it'll sound like this. Thank you. I go back to those tau plus tau minus events using that mapping, they will sound like this.
Oh, that's quite lovely.
Yeah, and you can actually hear the difference a little bit more in those two using a slightly different mapping of how you, again, taking the particle or detector characteristics and mapping on to sonic characteristics.
Yeah, and you can really hear that the energy in the form of motion is really divvied up amongst lots of particles in the bees, and so it takes longer for them to get out in the detector, whereas in the tau, it's just rump,
yep,
rump,
that's exactly
it, they're
right.
Out. They got so much momentum that they're carrying away because there are fewer buckets to fill with energy.
That's exactly
they just
right.
Fly,
that's exactly so. Right. And unfortunately, people on the podcast can't see the visual cues that we have with this, but we'll try to get some movies made for some screenshots, and
yeah.
You can post them along with the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think you can see and hopefully hear what one might be able to do with a tool like this, with allowing people to kind of explore the data, explore different particle physics experiments, explore different physics, but in a very different way than just picking up a book, reading a Wikipedia entry. One would hope then that as one plays around with this, there are things that they don't quite grok, they don't quite understand, and that inspires people to go look further. Or if they're working in an entirely different field, how they might attack those problems with something that they've maybe learned or thought about because of this tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Great. So in the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to ask you, in your life outside of physics research and this kind of physics education interface, what other things do you like to do? Are you a musician?
So I have been more of a musician in the past than I am now. When I was in undergrad at Rensselaer Polytechnic in upstate New York, I played in some bands, played the frat parties, played electric guitar, mm-hmm. played acoustic guitar, I played trumpet back in the day before that. And I did some electronic music classes at RPI as well. But when I graduated, I was really into guitar and playing in the band, so I worked in a music store for 4 years and sold guitars, played in some bands in upstate New York, and then I went and worked for GE for a while. And then I did a postdoc at Carnegie Mellon.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to grad school at RPI, postdoc at Carnegie Mellon. And throughout that, I did some playing in a band and played acoustic guitar and electric guitar. Now I play mostly at home. Played at a friend's wedding a while back. I think I'll play at another one this summer, but it's mostly for fun. Ride my bike. California, we get good weather, so
yeah.
I should be riding my bike to work. It's close enough and it's beautiful enough outside. I got to try to do that. My wife is a scientist as well. She's a geochemist at Northern Illinois University. Sometimes when I'm not at work, I'm talking different science. I get
yeah.
to talk geology and earth science beyond that. And then beyond that, I mean, look, dude, the truth of the matter is I love what I do. And when I'm not physically at work, I still like working on my research. I mean, we didn't mention, but now I'm working on these searches within the Babbar data set for physics beyond the standard model. We're looking for violation of baryon number.
Yeah.
I'm starting a new analysis looking for, basically we're going to see if physics changes as a function of how the Earth is oriented with respect to a distant star.
Oh,
it's a variation on the Michelson-Morley experiment.
Yeah.
This stuff is exciting. I mean, I sit at home. I like playing around with the computer code that we get to work with. I like to use this stuff to find new ways to visualize my own data. I play a lot of fantasy football when the season starts.
That's the football part of your
That is
your
the
hashtag
football.
At
yeah,
the
yeah.
Science Act Day.
And
yeah.
It's interesting. So when I pick up guitar, I've had people ask me this. They're like, "Oh, when you pick up guitar, do you try to take some of these sounds that you've heard and turn them into guitar stuff?" I'm like, "No."
Yeah.
When I play guitar, I want to just have fun. And I want to play covers. I want to play some Pearl Jam. I want to play Britney Spears song on my acoustic guitar. I don't want to do science and physics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that do a lot of statistics in sports, and I've absolutely played around with that myself, and I've used it as a teaching tool. When I play fantasy football, though, like, I don't want to do the big, you know, regression analysis and figure out it.
Bust out the neural network and start analyzing teams.
I started doing that at one point, and I realized, God, I'm going to turn this into not fun.
Right.
You know, I want to go with my gut, and if I fail, then I failed because of my gut. If I win because of my gut and not just because of some algorithm. And you
right.
can look, there's a skill in developing a right algorithm.
But sure, yeah.
During football season, I want to root for the Dolphins. I want to put together a team that, you know, has a chance to challenge for our fantasy football title. And
just have a good time with it.
Just have a good time with it. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right, Matt, thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate having the chance to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having me, Steve. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to SMU Voices. Learn more about Southern Methodist University at smu.edu.